The 2014 Winter Olympics are over. Most of the athletes have packed up and returned home. NST reviewer Jacob Blickenstaff has a few thoughts about how the Games participants utilized scientific concepts to go faster, higher, stronger.
By now, the 2014 Olympic Winter Games are over. The medals have been awarded, the crowds dispersed. But as I prepared this column and podcast, though, the opening ceremony had not yet happened. I still get to look forward to surprising wins and enjoy the drama of hard-fought competition. You may be wondering how science teachers could use the Winter Olympics to generate excitement in class. Now, though I'm sure there are many, many connections that you could make, I'm going to emphasize just three in this podcast. Energy transformations, aerodynamic lift, and sports physiology. A number of the marquee events in the Winter Olympics involve one or more people starting at the top of an icy or snowy hill, and they then do everything they can to get to the bottom of the hill as fast as possible. Bobsled, luge, and skeleton all happen on ice-lined tracks. The wide range of skiing events vary the number and spacing of gates that athletes have to navigate around, and the skill set they need to do so quickly. A number of the newer ski and snowboard events focus on executing tricks in a half pipe or after launching from a nearly vertical ramp. To a physicist, though, these events all look fairly similar. They all involve an object, the athlete or athletes, trading some initial gravitational potential energy for kinetic energy when sliding down the hill, and then dissipating the kinetic energy at the bottom of the hill when coming to a stop. An object's kinetic energy depends on its mass and the square of its speed. Since skiers and sleds don't really change in mass on their way down the hill, their speed determines their KE. Since greater speed means more kinetic energy, most skiers and sliders want to minimize the forces that could decrease their speed. Friction between their skis or the runners and the ice is one major factor, and pushing the air out of the way on the way down is another. After building up their kinetic energy on the way down the mountain, it has to be dissipated over enough time and distance that stopping doesn't cause an injury. At the bottom of the bobsled and luge runs, the ice is rough and snow-covered, and drivers can apply brakes. At the end of a ski run, you see skiers turn sideways and skid to a stop. In the end, all the potential energy the skier had at the top of the hill has been dissipated by friction and wind resistance when she slides to a stop at the bottom. These Winter Games in Sochi are the first time women have competed in ski jumping at the Olympics. Men's ski jump, on the other hand, has been contested since the very first Olympiad 90 years ago. Ski jump is another of the potential energy to kinetic energy transfer events I described above, but there is one very interesting difference. To maximize the distance the jumper travels, she needs to stay in the air as long as possible, and that means she needs to generate aerodynamic lift while flying through the air. In most of the sports I described earlier, winning is about going faster, but in ski jumping, winning can be about going slower if it keeps you in the air longer. The suits worn by ski jumpers are designed to catch the air, unlike the skin-tight suits worn by downhill skiers, bobsled riders, and luge drivers. When the ski jumper launches off the ramp, she holds her arms at her sides, and the suit is large enough to fill up much of the gap between her arms and her torso, and that increases the wind resistance on her. Ski jumpers also tend to be light, so the force of the air on them is relatively large compared to their weight. Prior to the mid-1980s, ski jumpers held their skis parallel to each other while in the air. And that makes intuitive sense. You have two flat boards close together and they almost make a single larger board. It turns out, though, that there's a better way. A Swedish jumper, Jan Bokov, popularized the now ubiquitous V technique, and that adds about 10% to the jumper's distance by increasing the aerodynamic lift or upward force on her while she's in the air. Now, a number of events in the Winter Olympics require a combination of two very different and perhaps even opposing characteristics: tremendous physical strength and very fine motor control. I think figure skating and biathlon represent this the best. Figure skaters must be able to execute jumps and spins that require strong legs and substantial core strength, but must also be able to place fingers and toes so precisely that they execute required turns and spins with great accuracy. The biathlon may be even a more extreme example. Athletes must ski as fast as they can on cross-country skis, then stop, and shoot small targets 50 meters away, either standing up or lying down. To be successful at the target shooting component, the athlete needs to pull the trigger between heartbeats, and that means he must slow his heart rate as soon as he stops skiing. It is difficult to imagine the level of control over one's body it takes to be a world-class competitor in either figure skating or biathlon. I hope you enjoyed the 2014 Winter Olympics and are able to find some fun ways to connect the events to your science classes.
For more of Dr. Blickenstaff's reviews, go to the NSTA website and search for Blick on Flicks.